Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of The Police and the People. On today's show, we're going to interview Lieutenant Chad Shevlin of the Raymond, New Hampshire Police Department, and we're going to have a management nugget today. We're going to talk about strategic planning and specifically SWOT analysis. Exciting stuff.
I am thrilled. I couldn't sleep last night, Tim, knowing we were going to be talking analysis. About it.
And that's SWOT with an O, not with an A.
Yes.
They're really fun stuff.
Yes.
This is the management boring stuff. But anyway, so Josh, why don't you talk a little bit about what GSPCZ does?
Yes. So we are Granite State Police Career Counseling, and we are an in-service training company. We mostly train emergency responders, you know, corrections, law enforcement, fire, so on and so forth. But we also do some trainings with more civilian-based organizations as well. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of good training that's coming up in the late fall here of 2019. You can go to our website if you want to look at all of the training available that we have, and you can find us at gs-pcc.com. I'll say that again, gs-pcc.com. You can also type in the entire name, Granite State Police Career Counseling, if you want to make your fingers tired. But that's what we've got going on, Tim.
Very nice, very nice. And we're happy to announce that we actually just signed on with a marketing company.
Yes.
Out of Boston, digital marketing. So hopefully when you do a search for us, it's going to come up on the first page.
Yes, yeah.
So
it was a little clunky before.
We're going to be a bit more visible. We've got a new website, and now we're going through some professional marketing.
Yes.
So we'll see how that goes, all right? Because we're moving on up.
Yes,
right?
I'm excited. I am. I'm excited about the future.
All right, we're going to skip Lucas. He doesn't have a mic because he's sick, but if you want to find out about his music, you can go to our previous podcast and get his website. And if you want to buy
LJ Productions, is that
LJ Productions? Yeah, and buy some music from him. You know, he's a struggling college student. So, all right, hit the music, brother. All right, everyone. With us today is Lieutenant Chad Shevlin. Chad works for the Raymond, New Hampshire Police Department. I met Chad a few years ago at some training he attended and was very impressed with him. And there's one thing about Chad. Chad is a veteran, a combat veteran, and he's here today to talk a little bit about his experience in the military in Iraq. And he was actually wounded very seriously and his recovery. And we're going to talk a little bit about PTSD and how it can be dealt with, if you will, within the police community. Because
quite a challenge.
Yeah, many people don't realize that police officers do actually, some go through PTSD.
Right.
You know, they may have, you know, if you see a child that's dead, It
very
could,
difficult.
It could impact you and really stick in your head. And if you don't find a way to vent that or to process it anyway, it can possibly haunt you. It just depends on the person. But we're going to talk about that today. So Chad, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Tim. I really appreciate it. And Josh, appreciate having me on the show. It's awesome.
Yeah, not a problem. Chad was very happy to be here so he could kind of get out of work, because apparently it was a pretty crazy week, huh?
It has been a crazy week.
Just for the record, Tim said he was impressed with you. He was impressed with me the first time we met, too. So you can take that for what it's worth.
So I'm not a very good judging character.
Oh, boy.
So how long have you been a police officer?
I've been a police officer for over 11 years now.
Okay.
Between Raymond PD and Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department.
Is that where you started?
That's where I started, 2008. Great agency to work for, large agency.
Yeah.
We relocated back home. So that's how we ended up back home in New Hampshire, because this is originally where I'm from. So.
Yeah, it's probably pretty quiet out there in Las Vegas, right?
Yeah, really quiet. No excitement whatsoever.
Especially for the midnight shift,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
no. There is well, no midnight. I don't know what I was going to say, because
there's no midnight there.
They party 24-7 there, don't they, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing is when you're in a city like that, everything's 24-7.
Yeah.
You come back.
Every shift is the same, right?
Yeah. Well, I would say everything's different, but look, yeah, it's just shifts different, but yeah.
How long were you with Las Vegas?
6 years.
Okay. Yep. All right. And then you moved to New Hampshire.
I did.
And you started with Raymond. Quite a difference in size of the police department there.
Yeah. Or 2,000 officers down to, 18.
18. And you were hired by Dave Salois.
At the time, yeah. Chief Salois.
Yeah. Dave Dave was a cadre in my police academy, and he was a patrolman. And on our graduation night, he was promoted to sergeant.
Oh, awesome.
They called him up on, or his chief, I forget who the chief was back then. They called him up on stage and promoted him to sergeant. That was pretty cool. And we loved it because we really liked him. The other guy that was there was just a real asshole. We did not like him.
You mean your other cadre?
The other cadre. Oh, okay. Yeah. It was huge difference between those two guys. I don't think they liked each other, to be honest with you. All right. So you were, you were with Las Vegas, and you've been with Raymond PD. But prior to that, you were in the United States Marine Corps.
Yes, I was. I joined in 1999.
99, okay.
Yep.
Hoorah. How old are you now?
39.
Okay. All right, man, I'm getting old.
Tim's 39, too. He says it all the time. It's been 39 14 times, I think.
Oh, I joined the Navy in 89.
Right on.
Yeah, so did 6 years.
I was nine years old then.
Yeah. So in the Marine Corps, tell us about that. Tell us about your career in the Marines.
Sure. So United States Marine Corps, I was in the infantry. I was attached to 1st Battalion, 5th Marines after I got out of boot camp, which is in California.
California, okay.
In Camp Pendleton. Great time. I was there just over 6 years, where I had to medically retire out.
Yeah.
I had the opportunity to go to Japan, Australia, all around the world, be part of the 31st MEU. And then I had the opportunity to go to Iraq in 2003 when the whole invasion kicked off.
So you were there in the beginning?
I was.
Okay. All right. So in what year was that?
It was in 2003.
2003. Okay. Yep. So now you're there with your guys, and what was your basic responsibility of your unit?
So we were a part of the Regimental Combat Team 5. We were pushing from Kuwait up to Baghdad to take over the city.
Gotcha. Okay.
This all started in motion from 9/11.
Of course.
In the workups and all that. So when that had happened, we knew we were going.
Yeah.
And it wasn't,
of course, yeah.
It wasn't if, it was when it was going to happen, right? So we started our workups prior to 2003 at the end of the year in 2002. And then we moved over, I want to say February 2003. It was at the end of January.
Okay.
Beginning of February that we actually entered in the country. I had been there, I think, 2 days, and my daughter, who is now 16, was born.
Oh, wow.
So I had the chaplain and the first sergeant come up to me and congratulate me on being a new dad.
That's not easy.
Yeah, that's not really what you think about when you're that was your first child?
That was my first child.
Yeah. That's the life of a military person, you know. Yeah, it's tough.
I can't say that was the way it was for me.
It was very
different when you stayed inside.
I was there. So you're there. That's your main responsibility, you said, from Kuwait to Baghdad, right?
Yeah, so we started in Kuwait, right at the border. And then by March 21st, we got the call to push through the line of departure and start heading up north.
Yeah.
Along the way, we had combat. Hip pocket stuff happened, throughout the way there. But really, the real big firefight happened when we started closing in on the city.
Oh, because they had probably collapsed their forces to protect Baghdad, right?
Yeah, there was several forces. They had the, if I can remember, the 1st Corps, 2nd Corps, 3rd Corps, and Republican Guard. The Third Corps were like your guys that were on the outside. None of them really wanted a fight. A lot of them gave up, and the trolls dropped their weapons. I remember having over 100 enemy prisoners of war in between our vehicles and escorting them to the interrogation teams to find out what was going on.
How many of you were escorting them?
12.
12. This is 100. At least you were armed.
Right. But, you know, they knew that we would take care of them because that's how the United States is, and, you know, right. Make sure that they were fed and taken care of, and that's what we did. That was a part of our mission. So if they didn't want to fight, we didn't give them a fight. Our right. motto was no better friend, no worst enemy.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. things to live by, you know what I mean?
Yeah. All right. So you're in Baghdad.
So
you push through.
And we get up to Baghdad, and the night of April 9th, we get stopped on the road, and my platoon commander, who's in charge of the whole platoon, mm-hmm. stops us and gives us a quick, what we call a frag order, really, really fast order, let us know that we have a Saddam sighting within the area, and we're heading to his main palace. If I can remember, I think it's called the Amala Palace.
Okay.
It was one of his main presidential palaces. So our job was to go and secure that area, and if we ran into him, we'd pay him a visit.
Right.
Unfortunately, we didn't run into him.
Just to say hi real quick.
You know, pop in, drop in, and say hey, how's things going? You know.
I understand Saddam Hussein. He wasn't a big fan of the pop in.
No.
You know.
No. Right. Yeah,
like on Seinfeld, they don't like the pop in. I don't think Saddam Hussein liked the pop in. Yeah.
You know, so we headed to the palace. They told us that the combat should be minimal and not a lot going on. Well, you know that thing called Murphy's Law?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
He had a real big part early that morning. And we get in there and we started fighting Fedayeen, Egyptian, you name it. And we were trading paint back and forth. I'm sure people have heard that before. Rounds going back and forth, RPGs flying overhead. I was in a AAV, which is an amphibious assault vehicle.
Okay.
A lot of people think of the Bradley. It's a troop carrier. It holds troops and mm-hmm. it can go in the water. That was kind of the cool thing because Saddam started blowing up bridges on the push into Baghdad.
It's not stopping you guys.
No, it didn't stop us. You know, the military could build quick bridges, and we would just go in the water and pop out on the other side. Yeah. So it was great.
Your tanks have propellers, right?
Yeah. Yep. So we roll up in there, heavy firefight. The firefight, they say, lasted between 12 and a half to 13 hours.
Wow.
I made it to like hour 12 and a half, they say. We were back and forth, heavy fire, lots of explosions, mortar rounds going off. They had piano wire across the road to try to take our heads off when we went through. But
oh my gosh,
the vehicles were higher than the piano wire, so it snapped the piano wire, and we just kind of laughed it off.
They miscalculated that.
Miscalculated, yeah.
Wow.
A lot of machine gun fire, we take that. So my vehicle became lead vehicle for the entire convoy in the melee of that attack. I mean, we had vehicles going left, right, just to get out of the firefight, you know.
Now, where were you in the vehicle?
So just to understand, so people understand how those vehicles work, picture a tank, and in the back it holds 12 to 18 fully combat loaded Marines. Mm-hmm. There's a big panel, big hatch in the back that will drop down when we run out the back, and then the vehicle will help give us protection with heavy guns.
Gotcha.
It's a Mark 19 and a 50 cal on it.
Yeah.
So it has a little turret, not quite like a tank. It's a small turret. It's on the right side. And it has a driver and a tank, a commander.
Yeah.
So it consists of like four of their guys that run that AAV.
That's their crew,
right.
Okay.
In the back, you have these things called air watch panels, and they pop open so the Marines can help protect the sides of the vehicle. I do that using my machine guns, things like that, because the sides need protection.
Right.
So, and it gives us situational awareness of what's going on. When they pull up to the objective, we need to come off and run through it. You know, mm-hmm. Marines just run through stuff and go through the other side.
Yeah, gotcha. It's kind of nice to know what you're going to get to.
That's really what our job is, just like the commercials, right? So, you know, we had the air watch panels open. RPGs, which is a rocket-propelled grenade. It's a anti-tank weapon. They put it over their shoulder. It fires a pretty big projectile. They were firing at that, at my vehicle, trying to stop it. Well, I remember at one point, RPG came and hit the side of the vehicle, but it wasn't an arming distance. They have an arming distance they have to reach. And
so it hadn't armed yet?
It hadn't armed.
Okay.
So I had went through a full magazine of ammo, and I looked, and I was like, wow, that went fast, right? And I dropped down inside to take cover, to reload, to pop back up. As I do, the RPG hits the side of the vehicle, and just the tail sticking out of it, just burning. Like, I could remember the sound, that fire sound coming from it. Didn't detonate, just sat there, and then eventually I think it fell off the vehicle. So I'm like, all right, now they're using big stuff on us.
Yeah.
Couple more, like, they'd shoot, they'd miss. RPGs aren't very accurate. Yeah. They kind of fly all over the place. We ended up coming up on, so the city was, if you think of like LA, very tight streets, a lot of very urban area. I remember passing this alleyway and seeing an RPG come straight at me. I was still in the vehicle at the time. We were still kind of moving, mm-hmm. and we had just stopped. Everything went eerily silent. And it came up underneath the air watch panels that are on the top, and there's a gap in between the air watch panel and the vehicle. And the explosion actually came up right into my jaw.
Man.
Disintegrated half my jaw, knocked out half my teeth. I had NVGs on because it was nighttime, which are night vision. Mm-hmm. They help us see. Those got knocked off my helmet.
Do you think they may have protected your eyes?
I think they protected one eye. They were called PVS-14s, and that's all they did was sit over one eye.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then they have, like, PVS-7s. Those are both eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I had my helmet on, my bulletproof vest, flak jacket, we call it. All that protected a lot, but my neck and my lower jawline was what really...
Was that exposed? Was that the difference?
Correct.
That area was exposed?
Yeah, it was. So it took off half my jaw. It missed my carotid artery, which is a pretty vital, vital piece of equipment there to keep your blood flowing.
Yeah, it is.
Almost severed that. Hit my esophagus. I couldn't talk. And detached my retina in my right eye.
Okay.
I came back up. I saw the silhouette of the guy. I shot. He went down. I can't tell you what happened to him after that. Then I realized I was in some trouble.
Yeah.
So I sat there and I tried to yell to my guys and I couldn't yell. I put my hand up on my neck and I could feel the blood hitting it. I could feel that I didn't have my face anymore. So, you know, kind of out of the fight at that point, but not out of the fight. So I sat down in the vehicle. My Marines start yelling, "I'm dead." I look at him, I grab one of them, and I give him a thumbs up. I put it like about 2 inches from his face, like, don't count me out just yet. You know?
Don't start taking my stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Still in your gear.
So long story short, I remember my platoon commander yelling for me, and then my guys are yelling. He's been hit. He's, you know. So I remember, like, looking at some of the Marines as they're running around, and they're looking at me ghost white, you know, and I'm like, oh, I probably look really good. Good thing I didn't have a mirror at the time. And I just start thinking, okay, I'm not going to take this lying down. I'm getting out of here. I need to meet my newborn and I need to get back home, my wife.
Good,
you know?
Attitude.
So they started bandaging me up because Marines, one thing that I've always loved about the Marines is that it doesn't matter what rank you are, you know how to step up and take leadership and roll with the punches, I guess.
Yep.
And there were some big punches. So my Marines start tending me, and they just go to work. I mean, they were just handling business like I wasn't even there, and I was their squad leader. So, you know, pretty vital piece, you know, that, but they're rolling and doing what they need to do.
Right.
I got off the vehicle. My platoon sergeant, he runs the whole platoon. He comes over, learns I've been hit. At this point, they took my rifle from me, so I had no rifle. And they're walking me to the track that had the dock in it. Navy corpsman, so
yeah,
my hat's off to the Navy. You know, those guys were lifesavers. And I remember getting shot at again. And I remember dropping down to the prone, and I had to rely on my guys to protect me and make sure that I walked out of there, right?
No, you're probably like, where's my rifle?
Right. Well, that's exactly what it was. It was parts of it. It's kind of like, you know, you're kind of going in and out of that fog of war. You're shocked on what happened, but you're like, all right, I got a job to do. They got me on another vehicle. I remember, like, you know, my team leader had gotten hit in that same blast. He lost his finger. on his left hand. And one of my younger Marines at the time got hit in the lung, and we didn't realize it was that bad. We just thought it was like an arm wound. But I remember my platoon sergeant, like, you know, going up to them and my platoon commander going, "Hey, we'll see you in a few days. You'll be back." And then they'd be like, "Corporal Shevlin, well, we'll see you when we get back." I'm like, awesome. So, from there, they put me on another vehicle and two CH-46s, which are those helicopters that have the two big props on them. Yep. They're troop carriers. They're not really attack choppers. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. They move troops and equipment.
Right.
Those two pilots landed in a hut landing zone at the palace, and they were called in by our forward observer, which that's like, you know, they call for fire, they call for air support, stuff like that. They landed under heavy fire just to get us out of there. So at this point, the Marines and the corpsmen put me on a gurney, on a stretcher, and they're trying to get me to the helicopter to flight line me out of there, basically. And I remember choking on my blood. And I tried to grab, of course, then the Marines are running across. They jump over this retaining wall and they drop me. I remember that. They pick me back up. Now I want to walk on my own at this point, but nobody will let me walk on my own. You know, they're like, "Oh, you've been hit, you know, right. Trauma.
Yeah.
So, I grab one of them and they're like, "He's going into shock. He's going into shock." I'm like, "I'm not going into shock. I'm just choking. I can't breathe. Like, let me up, you know?"
Yeah.
So they get me in the helicopter and they, you know, if you kind of picture the sides, it's like stretcher, and they're all like on top of one another. So I grabbed the crew chief, which he's the guy that like looks out the sides of the helicopter to make sure they're not going to hit anything when they go up and down. Mm-hmm. And I motion for him to write on a piece of paper, and he gives me his notebook, and I write, "Choking on my blood, let me up." So he grabs me from the stretcher and puts me in one of the jump seats. So now at this point, I'm sitting in the helicopter.
Was that better?
Oh, a lot better. All of a sudden, I probably wasn't, I mean, I don't know how it felt like an eternity, but, you know, it was a little while there that I started to panic a little bit myself, like, this is how I'm going to go?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I just survived.
Yeah, I just survived that. Now I'm choking on my own blood.
Were you in pain at all?
No, I was feeling pretty good. The morphine did a pretty good job at that.
Gotcha. Okay, all right.
And then probably adrenaline and everything else you know, kicking in. I just knew I should have ducked. So the helicopters go to take off, and the enemy force, they end up firing RPGs again. And luckily, the helicopter was able to maneuver out of the way. But you sit there and you think about it. All right. So I got to the helicopter. I got the first aid that I needed. And now I'm in a helicopter and it's lifting off and I'm going to get blown out of the sky. So then they flew me to Kuwait, which we had a trauma unit. It was like a tent hospital that General Mattis at the time had made sure that we had there for us and assured us that we were going to get the medical treatment that we needed. Mm-hmm. They put me in a high back Humvee, which is like an ambulance, brought me to that hospital, and then brought me into the doctors. They were, you know, cutting the clothes off, the whole nine yards. And then they asked, you know, what happened? I said, RPG. And then the last thing is I passed out from, you know, their narcotics and things like that to do the surgery. I probably woke up, I don't know how many hours it was after that. My jaw was wired shut. I had a tracheotomy, so I could definitely not talk, but I was breathing through my neck. And eye patch over my eye, I was seeing double because the retina had detached at that point.
Okay.
Just wanted to get word to my wife of what happened. She didn't know for 5 days.
Wow.
So I tell this story because I always feel bad for this corpsman that was in the hospital at the time, but he wanted to notify my wife on how I was doing because he thought she had been notified. And when notifications happen, someone physically goes to your door. Well, because my wife was having our child, I sent her back home to our home of record. So nobody physically went to the house to tell her that I had been injured in combat.
Okay.
So this poor corpsman calls and tells my wife that, you know, your husband's doing a lot better today. He's good to go.
But she never knew.
Yeah, she's thinking, what are you talking about? Oh,
she lost her mind. And I think really, really nerve-wracked the Navy corpsman, because he comes over to me and he's like, she didn't know. And I could just see the fear of God in his face. So she ended up getting correct word and made calls to command and then got confirmation that it was me. So my first conversation with my wife was me tapping on the phone.
Just tapping on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Just to let her know I was all right.
Yep. How long was it before you were able to speak?
Oh, speak? Oh, geez. Probably a good 2 to 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Long story short, I had over 16 surgeries. They lasted 18 hours or over to rebuild my face. They took hip bone, put it back in my jaw, gave me a nice set of chompers. Probably have over $1 million worth of work just in my mouth.
Wow. Wow, man. Wow.
Yeah, so.
What an experience. What an experience. Yeah. Now, so you're recovering. Where did you do most of your recovery?
So recovery happened in two places. It was Bethesda, Maryland at first, where they did some of the initial surgeries, but didn't have the staffing to deal with that. Great doctors did what they could.
Yeah.
Then they flew me to Balboa, California. That's where I finished all my outpatient treatment, and the remainder of the surgeries to where.
Is that near San Diego?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember Balboa.
Yep. It's right down the road from Camp Pendleton. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I was stationed in San Diego for a couple of years. So, all right. So you recovered there, and then you said you were medically released from the Marines.
Medically retired from the Marine Corps. Retired.
Okay. All right.
At that point, you've been a Marine for, you know, pretty much your adult life, correct?
Yeah, from age 18 to 25.
So, I mean, how do you at that point say, okay, I gotta change up the game plan now, right? I mean, that's a huge, huge life-changing event. Not just the injuries, but now I would assume you have a path, and that's got to change now.
Right? It was a huge path.
Were you planning on staying in the Marines?
Yeah, my wife and I had talked about it. I was going to retire. I always had plans also to become a police officer, but at some points they were telling me some of the surgeries were going to be so invasive that they would have to take bone from other spots that would compromise running, jumping, stuff like that. So I asked the doctors if they could figure something out that wouldn't prohibit that. Yeah, exactly. Once I started reaching, so when you have hip surgery, it's not the most pleasant thing. I got up that day that I had surgery and started walking around the hospital because they told me movement was the best medicine.
Yeah.
And having the power of my wife and my daughter at the time was motivation enough to get off my rear end and get moving.
Yep.
I couldn't sit there. I was too young to sit there. You know, I didn't want that to happen.
Right.
So, you know, over the 2 years of basically getting back on my feet, I started to run. You know, you crawl and you walk and you run. So that's really what I started to do until I could get to where I could pass a PT test again and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. When I retired out of the military, I ended up working for security over at the Nevada test site for a little while, which helped ground me out, which I think was good.
Okay.
What's the Nevada test site?
Nevada test site, well, everybody knows the infamous Area 51.
Right, yeah.
It's all part of that. I wasn't Area 51, but the test site.
So can you like climb walls and stuff too from being over there?
But
you don't have any bionic powers or anything?
No. Okay. No
bionic. I'm just curious.
No alien blood?
No.
DNA in there?
No.
I'm sure you saw the recent hype about the, I know it was just a bunch of crap, but about
it's great.
People rushing Area 51.
Go ahead and try. Have fun. Have
fun with that.
You'll give them something to do.
I'm sorry. We got off topic there. I apologize.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's part of the growth process there because, you know, while I was there, I got to do a lot of cool stuff, get back into training, get back to handling firearms again, shooting, you know, all that stuff kind of takes time after you've been shot. And I wasn't happy being in that role. I wanted to do more. So then Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was hiring at the time. And I'm like, I got it. I'm going to go do a nice, safe job like police officer. So,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of what rolled into that.
Gotcha.
Thinking at that point, my wife wanted to choke me. But
especially working for Las Vegas, right?
She's like, you did what? She's always been very supportive of all that, so.
Gotcha. Well, that's good. That helps tremendously
to
have that support system. Yeah. So you were with Las Vegas. Was the PT test difficult for you because of your injuries?
Or no, at the point, I had nursed myself back to full health, where that came very, very easy.
Oh, good. So good. All right.
No issue.
All right. So one of the things we want to talk about on today's podcast is post-traumatic stress disorder. All right. Do you feel that you suffered in any way from this? That you did it keep you up at night, or did you have any kind of recurring nightmares? And I don't want to get too personal, Chad. We're just kind of curious what your recovery method was, if you did go through that.
Absolutely, Tim. It was a challenge. You know, we first responders, military, we see the things that I think the human should not see in a lifetime, to be honest with you.
I agree.
And, you know, I had a lot of sleepless nights in the beginning, you know, where life was going, what could I do?
Yeah.
Try not to focus on that. I tried to, just keep moving forward. I mean, there was a point that I wasn't doing any work and I got a part-time job at Walmart being a loss prevention officer just to kill time. I had a full year with my daughter while she was born to be able to family, you know, family was my biggest rock, I think.
Were you still in the military at that point?
I was, yep.
Yeah.
So on the out process, which isn't easy.
It's not easy, but you had this little baby to help you get through.
Yep.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. I could see that helping you.
I'll come back to that's got to be a part of that process is saying, what am I going to do now? What's my purpose? What can I, you know, and you've got to have a purpose. I don't care what line of work you're in.
Right.
You got to have a purpose, you know,
purpose and goals. That's the forefront of anything you want to do, you know,
Yeah.
Don't, you know, if you're not learning, they say you're dying, right?
Right. Yep.
You always got to try to strive for that. And that's really what I did. And that was my recovery, believe it or not, getting out. It's the talking to the psychiatrists and stuff that happened now that wasn't really a thing yet. I had one psychiatrist the whole time through my recovery, come in my room and ask if I was okay.
And that was it.
And I remember messing with him and my wife laughed because I'd mess with the doctors all the time. I'd be like, hey, my heart stopped 4 or 5 times. Is that normal? And they'd look at me like, oh God, you know, humor is also a big help.
Yes.
and laughing, you know, so that, you know, the psychiatrist came in and I, you know, obviously get a lot of teddy bears and different things from people and showing their support, which that was wonderful all by itself.
Sure.
And I'd be like, yeah, that teddy bear is up there talking to me. And they kind of look at me for a minute and then I'd be like, ah, I'm just kidding. You know, so they don't like when you mess with them too much.
I was going to say, that's why he never came around again. He's, screw that guy.
Yeah.
But you think you mentioned that it really wasn't a thing yet to have a professional to speak to. Is that a problem that it wasn't just a part of your process?
No, it's a huge problem. And I think they're trying to correct that now. I've noticed that now. You got to, like, in the military, you got a lot of programs like the Semper Fi Fund, the Wounded Warrior Project.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing is mental health. Mental health's the biggest one.
Hero Pups is another one that I think is.
Yep,
is
Hero Pups.
We were talking about that, you know, providing therapy dogs to veterans.
Yep.
A huge, huge program.
Pets for Vets is another
Okay, that's
one.
Another
yeah.
one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. There's a lot of online ones. The Overcome Army is another one that I could think of. That's what they're there for. They're there to motivate you and get you off on your feet and get moving. That's the only way you're going to get through this. You know, you have to get up and just like in the Marines, we'd run right through the wall if you told us to. And you have to keep that mentality. Mm-hmm. And that was my biggest rock. And, you know, it took probably 12 years before I even partook in any of those you know, like the Semper Fi Fund or the Wounded Warrior Project. You know, over the years, I've done everything from skydiving to fishing to, you know, again, skydiving. If you're not scared jumping out of a plane.
You know, oh, my gosh.
Learning, so how many times are you going to roll the dice, man? I just scared it.
Yeah.
We'll keep at some point, don't you go, hey, I'm playing with house money here. I got blown up. I'm jumping out of planes. You know, I became a cop. I mean, at some point, you just say, all right, that's enough.
You can't stop living, you know?
Yeah.
That's true. You're absolutely right. And you said it best. I think I heard it from Tony Robbins. If you're not growing, you're dying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've got to enrich your mind, keep your body healthy.
Read
just
books.
Just keep moving forward.
You know, do whatever you can. Spiritual.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Mental.
Yeah.
So, you know, now you see it and people don't be afraid to talk to somebody. Sometimes family and, other first responders, other officers, other military, Yeah, they're great. They're great outreaches. But, you know, a professional with no biased opinion is probably even better to talk
to. They're
sometimes.
Trained. They know they're what trained.
They know.
For.
Yeah. They don't want, and that's the other thing is they don't want to re-traumatize what you saw. Mm-hmm. They're not there to go, hey, tell me what happened. Walk me through exactly what you were feeling at the time. You know, they want to get your brain firing right and be okay with the new normal in your life, you know?
Right. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like the mission is to for you to process it and then kind of put it in your rearview mirror, right? So you can move forward. So it's not in front of you, blocking you all the time. It's behind you, and you can move forward. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. You know, that's so important. You know, it's a part of me. The Marine Corps is a part of me. I'm really proud of it. I was very proud to be able to go over and do what I did for my country, and I don't have any regrets.
What advice would you give to a police officer who may be suffering from PTSD or at least maybe
just struggling.
A bit overwhelmed? Yeah,
just struggling
from the job. What advice would you give?
I'd give the same advice that I went through. You know, go talk to somebody. If you feel like talking to a buddy, don't turn to alcohol. Don't turn to those things, because guess what? It's going to make you more depressed. It's going to
just more problematic.
More problematic and cause more issues for you. You know, do things that are fun. Go take a moment and, you know, I've been told all the time, I'm on the go, go, go. Take a second, stop and smell the roses. You know, go hiking, go fishing. I don't know. Go watch a movie. Go do something that will give you a woosah moment.
Yeah.
Get you through things, you know.
It would seem to me that it's important to, like you said, not hide from it either. You know, it's a part of you. You know, if you've been through a traumatic event, that is a part of your life, and you shouldn't try to just tuck that away. Like we were saying, it doesn't need to be in front of you. It doesn't need to be blocking you, but you don't need to somehow forget it. It is a part of your life, and I don't know. It must be different for everybody how they handle that.
Right.
But if we're just trying to avoid it, we're not facing. Or not dealing with that trauma that's in front of you.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, I got to say, my wife has listened to many stories from my days as a police officer and processing whether it was a call that I was on and maybe a death scene or just dealing with, as you know, the administrative nightmares we have to deal with sometimes in personnel. All of that, she has been certainly my rock in helping me process a lot of that. So I give her a ton of credit for helping me out. But for those who don't have a spouse or someone they can talk to, do you know what kind of resources are out there for police officers, particularly in New Hampshire?
There's a online, it's called a Given Hour. I know you can go on there and it has a, you know, list of psychiatrists that will give an hour to help you out. You know, getting out there with your peers. And like I said, this, you can type in first responder retreats, things like that. I mean, mm-hmm. There's all kinds of stuff out there.
Something to help you out. Yeah.
You know, put mental health for first responders and you'll get all kinds of things. And there's so many nonprofits and there's so many people that do support what we do.
Right.
Even as officers and as military and, you know, they donate to these things and that's what they're there for. Don't be ashamed to use them.
That's the key. Don't be ashamed to use them. As Josh was saying before we started recording, is we got to remove the stigma.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
huge.
It's no pun intended. It's killing us. It's truly killing police officers, firefighters, first responders, anybody that's kind of in that high speed world. That worry of the stigma is truly killing people because they're not getting the help that they need. Because they're embarrassed, or they feel that if I tell people I'm struggling, they're gonna throw me off the force, or they're gonna make me leave my job. It's in my experience, it's just the opposite.
Right.
People want to help you, and I think people will admire you for having the courage to step forward and say, "Hey, I need a helping hand here."
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing to be ashamed of, in my opinion.
It's nothing to be ashamed of, and you hit the right word, which was courage.
Yeah.
It takes courage. Don't worry about what other people think of you.
Yeah.
You have to think of yourself.
Yeah. But, I mean, we talk about extreme ownership, and what's the saying? You know, if you don't face the problem doesn't get solved.
Nope.
Right?
Exactly.
So you've got to come to terms with that. And that's it's a difficult thing for people. You know, nobody at this table right now is saying, oh, it's easy. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
But that is such an important, I think it's a key to getting to that place where you can function and you can do your job and you can be a good family member, whatever the case may be.
All right. So we just got a little time notice from our engineer. So we're going to move on. So our next topic of today is it's a management nugget. So we're going to keep this short so it's not too boring for you.
different type of topic. You go from Chad's story, which is riveting.
Yes, absolutely. Now we're going to talk about a SWOT analysis. Yes.
Did everybody just hear the sound of everybody turning off our podcast? Right. Going, okay, that was good.
Or disease. SWOT analysis. All right, really quick. So this is our management nugget. I didn't call it a leadership nugget, but Josh was saying, but I think it is kind of more leadership too, because you need to be looking ahead. You need to be planning. And so strategic planning is just what it says, is when you sit down and you look at the future, you look at what you have, the resources available, you look at where you want to go, and you try to figure out the best path to get there. Does it make sense if you've got a plan to get there? And one portion of a strategic plan is something called SWOT analysis, SWOT, which is strength, weaknesses, obstacles, and what's the T for?
No, strengths, weaknesses,
opportunities and threats. I'm sorry. Yes. Opportunities and threats. So makes sense, right? If you're going to look at your plan, what's good about it? What's the healthiest part of it? What's going to get us through? What are going to be some of our obstacles, the weaknesses? What do we have to overcome? Opportunities, you know, maybe if we go in this direction, this could happen. If we go in that direction, that could happen.
Or one door closes, another opens. You know,
correct.
If you're losing staffing, do we have an opportunity to rebuild?
Yes. You know, and then the T is for threats. You know, what is out there that's going to possibly really get in your way? A lot of time, a threat would be with respects to law enforcement. And government work is going to be the budget funding,
sure.
Right?
Yep.
So that's typically...
Or your competitors, so to speak. So if it's in the business world, who are your competitors? If you're in the law enforcement world or the firefighting world, who could steal your staffing?
Yes. Yeah.
Those are your three, you know...
That's a big deal for Raymond PD.
Yes.
I got to say, Londonderry.
We lose a lot of guys.
Raymond.
Yeah. I wasn't going to say it, Chad. I was keeping my mouth shut.
We have a couple of Northampton guys too, I believe.
Yeah,
you guys must be so proud.
Yeah.
Well, I don't work there anymore.
After the show, Chad, we'll settle up with Tim. Okay.
All right. So, just on this topic, I pulled up some examples off the internet of some SWOT analysis, or actually some strategic plans of police departments, and I came upon Rockland Police Department in California, and I thought they did a wonderful job. So if you just do a search of Rockland Police Department in California of their strategic plan, you'll find it. But under their SWOT analysis, given that we really harp on leadership, I thought I would profile this one section that under their strengths, they put leadership and succession planning, which is extremely important in any industry, but certainly in law enforcement is, I find that some agencies just kind of deal with it when it happens. You know, someone retires and then it's kind of like, oh, I guess we got to promote, you know, and then they start kind of figuring things out, who they're going to put in that position. But you should be three steps ahead of that. You should start training your people in leadership development. Not only just sending them to training, but also having a leadership development plan within your agency and getting them exposed. We had, at my agency, we had a sergeant mentorship program. So patrol officers that were moving in the direction of wanting to get promoted, they could go through this 2-week mentorship program, and they were completely taken off the schedule and put with us sergeant of their choice. We didn't just stick them with anyone, because there could be some personality issues sometimes, but they had to choose two different sergeants to mentor with, one for 1 week and one for another one. And we think it was very successful. It helped develop them to understand what the first line supervisor role was all about, the nuances of it. So that was just something we did. And we also had a another program internally where we had a law enforcement training. I'm sorry, not law enforcement training, but leadership training in-house. And actually, I was tasked with developing that. And it was some leadership training, but it was also more of understanding policies within our agencies and all that. So it was very good. Did Northampton have something similar for leadership?
Well, I think the mentoring piece, yes, but it was much more informal. There was not a formal program or a process. But to kind of speak to that, I think the value is that once you have a few people who went through, whether it be formal or informal mentoring or learning about that next level, what you almost have is now you got like little mini sergeants out there as well, because now they're starting to think like sergeants rather than think like patrol, which is what you want. You want everybody kind of moving in the same direction, everybody thinking about the big picture, understanding what everybody else is doing within the organization.
Right.
And I've said to you, think of it, if you're a sports fan in football, the offensive line, you know, an offensive lineman doesn't just block the guy in front of him. They understand, I have to shift over here when this happens, or I have to shift over here when this happens.
For the run play or whatever.
Because there's all kinds of other stuff happening behind me or in front of me. They have to know everything that's going on all at once and operate in sync with one another. And I think that's kind of what mentoring programs do, is it allows employees, whatever field you're in, to understand everything else that's going on in the organization.
Right.
So they're not just living in their little bubble. They're working in a much broader sense.
Yeah.
From a military standpoint, Chad, how does that kind of jive a little bit?
No, it's 100% true. Like I told you, in Marines, every Marine to the private and PFC, they know how to do a sergeant's job. They understand how to step into that next role if they have to.
Right.
Which is, it's huge. That's huge because you want the mission to keep moving.
Right.
We'll come and go every day. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the mission is still the mission.
Well, think about it. As you said, somebody vacates a position of leadership or of management. And now what is, you just stop doing that? No, it's the job still has to get done. If you're the person that's handling, you know, payroll, let's just say, someone's still got to do the payroll. Trust me, no one does the payroll.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
there's problems.
Chad's got a sense of humor about getting blown up. You don't get him his paycheck, you're going to see a very, very angry guy over here. Two different situations, right?
Yeah, sure. Right. Mama's got to get new shoes.
Mrs. Right? Shevlin might come out of the woodwork on that. So there's things that have to get done, and so you have to have people that are ready to jump into those roles.
Yeah, the Navy had a similar program. It's called the Surface Warfare. I don't remember the full acronym. It's called ESWAS. But in order to get qualified for it, you had to learn every part of the ship and what the functions were, from engineering all the way to navigation. And then you were tested on it. There was a board they would convene, and you had to answer all these questions that they fired at you. And if you did okay, if you passed it, then you get to wear this pin. And typically in the Navy, if you didn't have that pin, you weren't going to get E6, E7 in that level. So that was you had to do it. On submarines, if you wanted to be a submariner, you had to do it. From E1 to the captain had to qualify. They called it something else, but it was the same thing. You had to know every system on that submarine. So I challenge every police department out there to have a similar program in place where you challenge your patrol officers to know every part of the department, and then maybe reward them in some fashion with a pen or something. I don't know. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think in some agencies, that's where you get like master patrol, or you know, you can achieve a certain rank because you have displayed a proficiency.
But do these departments, is it just because you've been there for so much time, or do you have to qualify?
Yeah,
for
so you
it
can have like fashion? Yeah, there can be like a social promotion in some places.
Yeah, my agency was just time served.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's my understanding there are certain agencies that if they offer a program like you said, where officers can almost take a test, go through a process, and show proficiency, then they can meet a or they can reach a certain level. And what in some places happens is if a supervisory position is vacated, they may be assigned to it temporarily because they've already shown that they could do that. So you could be a master patrol. There's a sergeant's position open. Okay, we're going to assign you as that temporary sergeant while we go through the process of having a permanent sergeant.
But think of that from a leadership succession perspective. If you've got an officer that knows the department inside and out, who better to promote than someone who understands, you know, all of the nuts and bolts. So cool. I think we've kind of run out of time here, haven't we? Wow. This has been a long one, man. Chad just wouldn't shut up. All right. In closing, everyone, I'll keep this very brief. If you know anyone who's looking to get into the world of law enforcement, there can be a lot of obstacles. There's a lot of testing processes and interviews and such. We have a guide that you can purchase on our website. It's called the Law Enforcement Test Preparation Guide. It's right there on our website, gs-pcc.com. So feel free to purchase that. It goes through Amazon, so there's no trickery involved there. Please subscribe to our podcast. We need these followers. We need you. We want you to follow us. We want other people to understand what our mission is. Our mission is to bridge the gap between police officers and the citizens that they serve. We want, and it's all about understanding perspectives. So you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and Alexa. For all you social media people out there, we are on Facebook, we are on Instagram, and we put out a monthly newsletter as well. If you're interested in signing up, just go to our website. It is the only pop-up on our website, I promise. And all it is just asking you if you want to subscribe to our newsletter. And that's about it. Anything from you, Josh?
Nothing. Nothing more.
Well, I want to thank Chad for coming out. Yeah, hopefully we got you out of work a little bit early.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
We love it. Thanks for telling your story. We truly appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Feel free to tell your boss every Friday you have to come. You know, and I got to leave early.
My boss is Chief Michael LaBella. He took over for Chief Slois. So.
We won't let him know what days we record. So you go, oh, yeah, I got to leave again early. Sorry, I got to leave.
Yeah. Chief LaBelle, we need Chad here, so you got to give him up on Fridays. All right. All right, everyone. Thank you. Be safe out there. All right.